Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Thursday, June the 12th. Can you believe that it's almost halfway through the month of January? Today, we're going to catch up with our good friend Barry Jacobson, and we're going to go back to our series from World War II. And today, we're going to be looking at the historical period. Excuse me, Ron. Sorry about that, folks. Let's take a little break, and we'll be right back. Well, I'm sorry about that, folks. We had a little... There we go. Excuse me for a second. Let's shut that off. Sorry about that. Well, we had a little technical problem there, folks. Sorry about that. What I meant to say is that today we will be looking with Barry at the period right after Pearl Harbor. This is, of course, a very important period for the United States because it's not only a military issue, it's also a psychological issue. The United States had never been attacked as it was in Pearl Harbor that Sunday, December 7th, 1941. So we're going to be looking at that, the aftermath, and some of the things that happened in 1942. Let me say hello to my good friend, Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well, Silvio. It's strangely rainy out here in San Diego. So we're both enjoying it and despising it at the same time. This is very unusual for us to get any rain whatsoever. So no one here quite knows how to handle it.
Well, wait till you get into traffic. I guess that's when it becomes a real issue. We're going to get rain probably here in about a couple of hours, too. So I think it must be a national rainy moment. But I mentioned in the introduction that we're going to be looking at the period right after right after Pearl Harbor, when the United States goes into a very difficult period of time. Not only is there a military challenge, but I would also argue, Barry, you probably agree with me on this, also a psychological challenge because we had never been hit like that before. And the country was on a war footing that most of the citizens at that time probably were not familiar with. Certainly World War I, but we were never attacked in the United States the same way. And I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about that and also give the listeners a timeline of where we're going to go in tonight's episode, Barry.
Yeah, sure. Let's start with that. In the last episode on December 7th, the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, we in fact talked about Pearl Harbor, where the war begins for the United States. Of course, the war has been going on in other parts of the world for several years. Germany had at this point overrun much of Europe and was fighting in North Africa against the British, and Hitler's armies had penetrated into Russia, where Stalin was holding on for dear life. The Japanese, meantime, had been operating in China for some time, and the rape of Nanking was something we had talked about in some of our past shows, had already taken place by this point. But America had been, sleepwalking or dreaming during this period, trying to stay out of the war and thinking they could do it. It was felt that after World War I, where we had gotten involved with what was clearly a European, squabble that didn't involve us, at least in the minds of many, that we had no business trying to bail out Europe a second time. And there was a very strong anti-war movement in America trying to keep us out of the war. And that changed literally overnight with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. On December 7th, of course, the day that will live in infamy, as Roosevelt famously said in his December 8th speech before Congress, in which he asked for a declaration of war and of course, got it. In that one day, American minds changed, and America became aroused in exactly the same fashion that Admiral Yamamoto, the commander of the Japanese forces that attacked Pearl Harbor, had warned his countrymen would happen. And he was a sleeping giant.
Right. You mentioned in the email you sent me earlier today that there were long lines at the recruiting stations or recruiting offices, military recruiting offices, days after people signing up to go to war. You know, just an amazing development. But let me ask you a quick question about the readiness of the military, the U.S. military. It's one thing to have emotion and to have passion to go in, but you still have to have a ready military. What kind of shape were we in? I mean, what did the military commanders tell President Roosevelt after the attack? He may have already known how bad it was, but what did they tell him, Barry?
Well, first of all, the American military was not prepared in any way, shape, or fashion. Our military was woefully undersized. We had less than 250,000 men in the military at the time. Our fleet was, badly banged up in Pearl Harbor. Most of the battleships were either sunk or wounded and were out of commission. We had only 3 carriers left in the Pacific Ocean. In the Atlantic, we were a little better off, and in fact, would quickly be working with the British Navy to convoy supplies over to Britain. We'd already begun the convoy system. And really what made us able to quickly get into that war the way we did and turn things around in a fairly rapid fashion, which we'll talk about in the coming weeks, was that the Lend-Lease program had gone into effect earlier in 1941, in which Roosevelt swore to make America the arsenal of democracy. And we had ramped up our industry in order to supply Britain, our now ally, but at that point just our friend, with what Winston Churchill called the sinews of war, basically weapons, that all they needed were the tools and that the British would do the work. So America had been supplying those tools through Lend-Lease, convoying them across the North Atlantic. And so we had the industry. The industry was ramped up for war, and that helped us a lot. We also had Detroit back then. Detroit is a mess today, but back in 1941, Detroit was the industrial heartland of America. And all the big auto manufacturing plants quickly changed to war production, producing just incredible numbers, vast numbers of tanks, trucks, jeeps, not just for us, but for our allies as well. Even the Russians got massive support from us. We were outproducing both Germany and Japan by a factor of 100.
Wow.
100 times as much equipment in almost every category.
Yeah, I was thinking
may I just have one last
thing? Yeah, go ahead.
Before I get off the subject and get into the meat of things, that first month after Pearl Harbor, 1 million Americans enlisted in the military in the various branches. It's a tremendous number, and it apparently the lines were 6, 7, 8 hours long just to get into the recruiting office.
Wow. That is remarkable. That is remarkable. I was also going to say it is remarkable that you can change an automobile manufacturing plant into one producing tanks. It sounds easy on paper, but you got to retrain people, I suppose. I mean, the concept of the assembly line works both ways, but it is different to put together a tank than it is an automobile. Now, in our show today, we're going to go from very early 1942 to what point, Barry?
Well, actually, we're going to stay in 1942. The timeline is we're going to cover the first battles of World War II for the United States, which all take place in the Pacific Theater. We're going to talk about Wake Island very quickly, which was the Alamo of the Pacific, and then quickly go over to the main theater in the first few months, which was the Philippines, where General MacArthur was in command. And the Japanese quickly landed after the attack on Pearl Harbor and began what would be known as the Battle of Bataan. So that would be the meat of it. And in the next episode, we'll take us into April and May through June of 1942. And we'll be talking about the Doolittle Raid and the Battle of Midway, which was the turning point in the Pacific.
All right. Well, let's get started, Professor. Where do we start in 1942?
Actually, we're going to stay. December.
I had to call you, Professor. You knew I was going to do that at some point in these shows. So, go ahead, Professor.
Well, thank you. I'll take that honorary professorship.
Absolutely, you're an honorary professor on our show.
So, in December 8th, 1941, the day after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese made the first attack by air on both the Philippine Islands and on Wake Island, which is directly due west of Midway Island and the Hawaiian Islands, where a garrison of about 500 Marines and an airfield existed. And of course, the Japanese wanted to eliminate the airfield. A good 12 hours, probably 9 hours, after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese air attack on the Philippines caught the American Air Force in the Philippines on the ground. Through sheer incompetence, the commander of the American forces, air forces in the Philippines, had not managed to scramble his planes and keep a persistent and consistent air patrol to watch for incoming Japanese, even though he knew that Pearl Harbor had already been attacked, and Admiral Nimitz had ordered them to assume air patrols and expect an attack. So the Japanese gained air supremacy just the same day, essentially, 12 hours later, even though it was December 8th because of the international timeline. They were a day ahead of Hawaii. The Philippines was attacked and their air force was caught on the ground. The landings didn't occur until the 10th of December, when the Japanese landed two divisions, one of which, the 16th Division, had been responsible for the rape of Nanking, under a general named General Hama. And they landed on the island of Luzon, the northernmost and central island, or main island, of the Philippines. MacArthur's forces quickly fell back to the Bataan Peninsula and adopted a pre-war strategy, which had already been planned for, in which the very heavily mountainous and wooded Bataan Peninsula would be defended. Bataan guards the entrance to Manila Bay, and the plan was to deny the Japanese entrance into Manila Bay, which was a major naval base or naval harbor. The harbor is warded by both the Bataan Peninsula in the north, and then just off the coast of the Bataan Peninsula, the very mouth of the bay, is the island fortress of Corregidor. And that's where MacArthur's headquarters was. So the Japanese landed, and Hama was given 50 days to take the Philippines. It, of course, would take him quite a bit longer, but we'll get to that in just a minute. So that's on December 8th. At the same time, on December 10th, the Japanese began to attack Wake Island. And Wake Island, as I mentioned earlier, was called the Alamo of the Pacific. The first landing actually was December 11th, not the 10th. There's only 500 Marines there and a couple naval guns defending this thing. They managed, though, to sink as they were coming in with their shore-based naval guns. The Marines managed to sink three light cruisers. I'm sorry, that's what they sent in there. They sunk one light cruiser and two destroyers. These are the first Japanese naval vessels sunk during World War II, and that was in Wake Island. All total, over the next about 15 days, they had two landings on Wake Island. The Japanese sustained some 1,000 casualties to 52 Americans dead. The Marines just fought like wolfhounds, like bulldogs. And the Japanese did succeed in taking the island, but at a high cost. Ships, planes, and men. So Wake won instant fame, and in fact, they made a movie in 1943 about Wake Island with an all-star cast. And that's really where the first medals of honor also are given out to defenders of Wake Island. It instantly makes heroes of these Americans. And this is a time when things are pretty damn bleak, for the Allies throughout the world. This is the high water mark of the Axis of World War II. The Germans, I already mentioned how far the Germans got. The Japanese at the same time, over the next 3 months, would overrun Indonesia, Burma, Malaysia, Indochina. They would land in Guinea. They would threaten the Australian islands and the Port Moresby in the northern part of Australia, the Solomon Islands, and, of course, they land in the Philippines. So it's a very black time for the Allies, and any little bit of heroism is, of course, exaggerated and focused on, and Wake becomes the first of these heroic defenses.
But the country needed that, Barry, as you were saying. The country needed those little victories,
Absolutely.
Just to move into, or just if nothing else, to pick up the enthusiasm. You know, it sometimes that happens in sports. You know, you and I are sports fans, and you know how sometimes in sports you need little victories throughout the season to get the fans excited that there's a future for the team. And I would think that that's what was going on at that time, just some victories, little victories here and there. I would assume that made it even – that also those heroes made it, you know, became easier to recruit more men to go to war, Barry.
Well, that's right. And unlike today, Hollywood got completely behind the American war effort in World War II. Frank Capra, within a few months, made a series of documentaries to be shown in the movie theaters called Why We Fight. And if you get a chance to go onto YouTube, I recommend this to anybody. Why We Fight, yeah, they're a little, I'm sure they're jingoistic, they're propaganda, they're real flag-waving kind of movies, but that's exactly what the American public needed. And, of course, back then it was a much less jaded American audience, and they, of course, bought into this. Really got behind the war, not that we needed a lot of help after Pearl Harbor, getting people behind the war, but also kept us focused on why we're fighting the fascists in Italy, the fascists in Germany, and, of course, Japan. And by the way, Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor. Germany did not, but nevertheless, on December 11th, 1941, several days after Pearl Harbor, Germany declares war on the United States. Hitler declares war on the United States as in response to his pact with Japan, the Iron Treaty or the Iron Alliance. The Pact of Steel. That's the word I'm looking for. Pact of Steel. And, you know, historians have since said that Hitler made a huge mistake because there was no sentiment to go to war against Germany at that point within the United
right.
States. He could have saved himself much grief, possibly, by letting Japan handle the United States and continue to focus his attention on Britain and Russia.
Right. No, I think that's true, don't you think? Don't you think
I
that's
think
true?
Is.
Because, I mean, the fact is, if you look at the anti-war, if you study the anti-war movement, 1939, 1940, 1941. It was not about Japan. I mean, it was all about what they call a European war. And,
that's
you
right.
know, people like Charles Lindbergh, who was one of the most outspoken men of the movement, I think it was called America First Movement, that's what they were talking about, a war in Europe. Nobody was really, to my knowledge, other than maybe people within the government who knew what was going on in the Pacific, but I don't think no one in the public was really talking about going to war with Japan, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Barry, but I think that's the reason that the attack was even more shocking, because it was like nobody was expecting this, or at least most people, I should say.
No, you're right. Certainly the highest levels of planning, there was plans in case of a Japanese attack, and, you know, people planned a case they had to go to war against Germany. But it caught a lot of people, particularly the, you know, general public, completely off guard. So, continue with the narrative, in the Philippines, MacArthur has evacuated his forces to Bataan Peninsula, and General Hama begins the campaign against Bataan that goes on from the 7th of January, 1942, until the 9th of April, and the Americans back home are listening constantly to radio broadcasts from Corregidor, the voice of freedom, I'm sorry, voice of America, telling him how things are going. And Americans at nighttime, after they got off work, would huddle around their radio. Television wasn't invented yet. Radio was the main means of communication. And, you know, along listening to the local games and sports and boxing, Americans would listen to the war news. And so for those first few months of World War II, all the news was about what was going on Bataan. And it was really a heroic defense, Silvio. As the Filipinos, there were basically 72,000 defenders, of which about 6,000 were Americans. I'm sorry, 15,000 were Americans. The rest were Filipinos trained by America, all under the command of MacArthur. Slowly gave ground, one step at a time, fighting very doggedly against the Japanese. And as time went on, dysentery, typhus, dengue fever took its toll. There were never enough food to supply all the men on the Bataan Peninsula. It wasn't just fighting men. It was also civilian contractors. It was nurses. A lot of mouths to feed. And the Japanese timetable was terribly upset. In fact, Hama, the Japanese commander, was slowly losing face as his 50-day timetable went right out the window with this, this dogged defense. Finally, by basically in April, let me find my date here, by 12 March 1942, MacArthur is ordered by by President Roosevelt to evacuate. The situation is grave. The defenses are being pushed back further and further. And the United States couldn't lose MacArthur. MacArthur was the hero of World War I. He had been our leading general throughout the interwar period, including chief of staff of the Army. He had retired and been brought back out of retirement to take over just before the war in the Philippines and prepare defenses in the Philippines. So he was evacuated by PT boat on 12 March. And he said to the Filipino people, once he arrived in Australia, these famous words, "I shall return." And the Filipinos took that check to the bank, and for the next 2.5 years, it'd be 2.5 years before he came back. The guerrilla movement within the Philippines that grew up after the fall of Bataan, which, by the way, was also organized by the American OSS and supported by the American OSS, they would wait for MacArthur to return. And you could say that the reason in 1944 that we landed in the Philippines at Leyte Gulf was MacArthur honoring that check he wrote and returning to the Philippines, because Admiral Nimitz was against it. He was for bypassing the Philippines and concentrating all our effort against the Japanese homeland.
Right. One quick note, Barry. I wanted to make a quick point here. This is the same MacArthur, of course, that we would be talking about roughly 9 years later in his confrontation. That's obviously not a World War II topic, but it's the same man the same general who had a confrontation with President Truman later in 51. So I just wanted to put that into the story. The great MacArthur, one of the great generals of American history, I'll put that.
Yes, and in fact, he was the most celebrated general. You could argue Patton, you can argue Eisenhower were equal in fame, but nobody was probably more respected in any capacity in our entire military, probably, than MacArthur.
Absolutely.
But it'd be 2.5 years before he could honor that promise in which he lands at Leyte Gulf in 1944 and says, "I have returned." In the meantime, the Philippines would suffer some 90,000 casualties due to Japanese atrocities against civilians.
Amazing.
But Bataan surrenders finally on 9 April. Corregidor will hold out for another month, the island fortress. But what follows the fall of Bataan is one of the great atrocities of World War II. The garrison that surrendered was, by this point, much diminished by disease and casualties, but it was down to some 60,000 Filipinos and 15,000 Americans, and they were marched the next day, forced march, some 65 miles. In some of the worst heat, tropical heat, with no water and no food. Many of them wounded, all of them sick for the most part, and certainly undernourished. And for some reason, known only to the Japanese, and we can speculate why this is, but the Japanese refused to use trucks and other transports that were readily available, and instead forced them to walk. And as they walked, men fell out and were bayoneted or beheaded by the Japanese.
Man.
If you stopped to ask for water, you were killed.
Wow.
All total.
Pretty.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's pretty brutal. I mean, that's brutality of the worst kind. I mean, you've got them prisoners already, you know?
Yeah, and imagine the heat. I mean, if you imagine the worst heat in Arizona or Texas and add about 20% more humidity.
Right.
Which in Texas, that's a lot. I mean, it's already pretty humid.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we're talking about. And if by the time it was done, several days later, 600 Americans were dead. That's an estimate. The numbers are speculative. Nobody knows for sure. And it's estimated some 8,000 Filipino soldiers died on the march.
Wow.
They marched from Bataan all the way to Camp O'Donnell in central Luzon.
Can you repeat the number of American dead? I missed it. You said 6,000 or 600?
600 American dead and some 8,000 Filipinos.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. Just wanted to make sure I understood you correctly. That's got to be one of the most brutal days in American military history, I would think, Barry.
Well, the surrender of Bataan was the largest surrender of American forces. Of course, most of them were Filipino, but the largest surrender of American forces in our history, with the exception of the American Civil War.
Wow. I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and as far as the amount of Americans killed, it dwarfs anything the Germans ever did. You know, we talked about the Malmedy massacre, you know, where 120 Americans were killed in Malmedy in the Battle of the Bulge by the German SS. This was 600 Americans. And that just begins the number, because when these guys get to the POW camps for the next 2.5 years, they are treated in the most brutal of fashion, and many of them don't survive.
Wow. Barry, let me take a quick little break, and then we'll come back with another quick segment on this amazing episode from World War II. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas with our friend Barry Jacobson. We're talking about World War II, 1942. One question, Barry, from our last segment that I wanted to ask you. How much of this brutality in Bataan was known back home? I mean, how many people knew just how bad it had been?
Very few initially.
Okay.
But word got out because during that death march, many men escaped from the march, Filipinos and Americans. Almost 12,000 actually escaped. And when they escaped into the bush, they formed guerrilla units. And the OSS was able to drop radios into them, in which they could then communicate back with their counterparts in Australia and so on, where American headquarters was being set up, or other places. And so word quickly got out to what was going on. Now, at Wake Island, some 98 American contractors on December 23rd, when the island fell, the Japanese admiral took the prisoners off and had them executed. These are civilian contractors. The Marines were taken into captivity and forced into forced labor, mostly in China. But 98-some prisoners were executed. And one escaped temporarily and was able to record it on a rock nearby. He was then captured and personally beheaded by this ship and the Japanese admiral. But that rock gave us the number of men killed, murdered. By the way, here's an interesting story, Silvio. One of those Marines from Wake Island, his name was Taylor, had been taken to China and put to forced labor during the war. And at some point he escaped during the war, escaped from prison camp, actually jumped off a train that was transporting him from one camp to the next with another fellow who broke his leg on the fall and had to be left behind. But Taylor moved on, evaded a capture by the Japanese, and eventually was picked up by the communist Chinese guerrillas who were fighting against the Japanese. And these said to him, oh, you're an American. We're friends with America, because they're part of the anti-Japanese resistance. And he was taken to a camp, a communist camp, and fed and clothed and helped to get back to American lines. And one of the guy who was in command who helped him out was no less than Mao Zedong.
Oh, my goodness. You talk about a small world.
Yeah, he actually
what an amazing
featured, The future chairman now.
Yeah. The future, you know, the future, the big guy, the big fish, whatever you want to call him, of China.
Right.
That is an amazing story. I had no idea. I do have one follow-up question, if I may, on that rock where the Marine wrote that number. How did we get that rock?
Okay, it was the rock was a boulder. When I say a rock, it was a large rock. And it was right by the shot, right where the men were shot or executed.
Okay.
And after the Japanese had finished and he escaped, he came back to that rock before they recaptured him, and he carved that on it. And that rock is still there if you ever want to go see it. Not the chance, but it's at Wake Island.
I see. So it was there for I guess when people arrived or whatever, they saw the information on the rock. Well, I wonder the gentleman, the Marine who was, you know, who met the future Mao Zedong. I wonder if that man was old enough or was able to see the problems with China later and the eventual reestablishment of relations with China. I wonder if he was around all that time, Barry. That would have been an interesting. I would have loved to ask that guy that question. What'd you think of China now, you know?
That'd be a great question. And I don't know when the fellow died. I don't know exactly, but he appeared in a History Channel episode called Wake Island, the Alamo of the Pacific, that was made in the 1980s. So he at least lived that long. So my guess is, he probably, obviously saw Nixon go to China.
Right.
He did live
he would have been
long.
Old enough. Yeah, he would have been old enough because that happened in 1970. So assuming he was a man, let's say, no older than 30 during that time, he would have been a man in his 60s or early 70s by the time that Nixon went to China or Carter established relations with China in 1978. Well, as we come to an end in this episode, set up the next one, and where do we go in the next episode?
At this point in the war, nothing but bad things have been happening. Bataan has fallen. Corregidor will fall the next month. Of course, we just talked about Wake Island. The Japanese are sweeping throughout the world, as the Germans are. And by May of 1942, you could call that the high water mark of the Axis powers. If you were a betting man, you might want to bet on that. So President Roosevelt turns to his military planners and says, we need something that looks like a win for the folks back home. And the answer comes from a fellow by the name of Jimmy Doolittle, who comes up with a novel way of tweaking the Japanese beards or tweaking the lion in his den. And that will be the Doolittle Raid. We'll talk about that next.
Isn't that a fantastic name, Jimmy Doolittle? I just love that name.
It is so ironic.
You think of a guy with a trumpet. You think of Jimmy Doolittle, you think of a guy with a trumpet for some reason.
Right. Like a musician.
Yeah. I don't know why, you know, you do. I know he was a great military man, but that's what you think of, you know, a guy with a trumpet. But so in the next episode we'll get into that small victory of the Doolittle Raid that, as you say, was a small victory, but a victory that the country really needed. But you're exactly right. From what I've read of that time period, I remember a book by Winston Churchill about World War II, and he mentioned how bleak things were and how bleak they were for England at this time. It's amazing. If anybody had said to you and I, let's say we were around back then and doing a show, and someone had said, you know, 3 years from now, Japan will surrender and Germany will be defeated, I'm not sure we would have jumped on that bet, Barry.
When you look at the wars we fight today, which are against much smaller forces, much less powerful forces than Germany and Japan, who are nation states and, in fact, great empires. And we finished those wars in less than 4 years. And yet we can't finish in 12 years what began on 9/11. Actually, it's been, 16 years now. It's amazing how things have changed.
Well, it really makes a difference when you're fighting to win. I think that's what I would say with my limited military knowledge. But if you fight to win and you're willing to use nuclear bombs to make your point, I think you have a better chance of bringing it to an end. It's a little bit like Sherman during the Civil War. He wanted to bring that war to an end, and he did whatever it took. I'm sure that it was not nice, and there were a lot of brutal points, and there were probably a lot of atrocities. But the quicker you end the war, I think the better off everybody is there.
I think you're absolutely right. And nothing is benefited by a long and prolonged war, not your enemies,
no.
Not you at home. And I think if I can say one last point before we close for the day, World War
sure.
II was total war in a way that young people today probably don't understand it and would think it abhorrent. In fact, students today in college are often taught that, you know, we committed atrocities also by the things we did. But in the terms of World War II, that was the way that war was waged, and we didn't start it. It was started by the Germans, first in Madrid, as we talked about in earlier episodes, and during the Spanish Civil War, and continuing right through the Blitz of London, which they bombed whole cities, the atrocity bombings of Warsaw, and, of course, the mass killings in Russia, the rape of Nanking, and the bombing of Pearl Harbor. These are all part and parcel with the doctrine of total war, which says you're not just fighting the military of the enemy, you're fighting the enemy people. Everybody in the enemy nation is your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So we responded in kind, and we got better at it than they did. That's why we won the war. But it wasn't our idea, and that should always be kept in mind that, yes, we use nuclear weapons. Yes, we firebomb cities, ultimately, to break the will to fight, like Sherman did when he marched to the sea, burning Georgia in the process.
Mm-hmm.
You break the enemy's will to fight by destroying their means to fight.
Right. It's brutal. It's ugly. But it's how you win. And I think you're right. I think a lot of young people today, I think, by the way, if I could just say one last thing, I think that may have been, I don't know if the producers of that movie intended it to be this way, but I think for a lot of people, Saving Private Ryan was probably the first time that they were ever really exposed to what war is really like, you know, because that Saving Private Ryan got really real, didn't it? And I think for a lot of people, you know, who maybe like me, who grew up watching The Longest Day, well, The Longest Day is a great movie, but it's not Saving Private Ryan in terms of you know, the graphic description of people being killed and the atrocities of war, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, one thing Saving Private Ryan did that was so much better than in its own way than The Longest Day, which, by the way, is an excellent movie and shows much more of the D-Day landings than you see in Saving Private Ryan, but the sudden brutality of death in combat, it was never showed better than Private Ryan, where one minute you're talking to a man and the next minute his brains are all over you.
That's right. No, I tell you, because our boys were 8, 9 years old around that time, and I remember I had difficulty having them watch it, not because it was a bad story, but because I felt that it was a little bit too much for a 9 or 10 year old boy to watch, but nevertheless, they still put it in when I wasn't home and watched it anyway. But I mean, it was just it was a very rough movie, I think, for a kid. Well, Barry, as always, we're grateful to you for your time, and we'll continue the episodes the next time. We may, from time to time, break into a current events show, and that's because there's a lot of current events going on with Russia and these other things. So we may, from time to time, break from World War II and do a show about national security. But we're going to try to stick to these World War II stories because, Barry, you're absolutely wonderful to do a show with. It's just great to sit here with you and do it.
I appreciate
great.
That. And I enjoy it. I think it's, you know, this is a war that needs to be talked about because it was, in fact, the greatest war in human history.
That's right. That's exactly right. No, you're right. And the heroes that came out of that war, some of them were presidents of the United States. And that's another thing that we need to remember. You had Eisenhower, you had Kennedy, you had Johnson, you had, I think, Nixon. And he did serve, I don't know what capacity, but Ford served. I mean, he had a lot of men who later on played a role in the country's politics that came out of that war, Barry.
It was really the war that shaped the world that we live in.
That's exactly right. Well, my friend, enjoy your day. And we'll figure out when to do this again. I hope it's very soon.
Well, good luck to your Dallas Cowboys next weekend.
Yeah, well, I won't say anything about San Diego this day, but your Chargers, probably not a good topic.
I just may become a Cowboy fan from now on.
Okay, well, that we need you. We need you over here. All right, Barry, have a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right. Thank you so much. Barry Jacobson, our great friend. We talk so many great things with Barry. We've been doing these series about World War II, and they're just absolutely fascinating. I know you're enjoying them as much as we are. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.